Welcome today to another Ag Perspectives podcast. I'm Ron Hayes, and joining us today is Harrison Pittman, the director of the National Agricultural Law Center based at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Harrison, let's talk a little bit about some of these things you were talking with Oklahoma Farm Bureau members today. You tried to give them a little feel of what ag law is really about. It's a wide ranging scope of things you're actually trying to deal with.
Absolutely. And that's our challenge every day, myself and the staff that we have. From, you know, I mentioned the folks that we have an attorney devoted just to food safety and food labeling, another on environmental law, another just on ag finance and credit, another who focuses on ag labor and international trade and issues of that nature. But that doesn't even cover everything. You know, we still have all your farm programs and specific issues that come up in that, international issues. It's a fascinating area that almost has no boundaries, and it's as complex as the industry itself. It's really fascinating.
It seems that look at all the issues going on today, you mentioned that kind of that give and take of litigation versus regulation and the intertwining of those two concepts. It seems like we're constantly almost playing defense in a lot of these areas.
Yeah. You know, the metaphor, I may have used it today, but I often use this, that, you know, oftentimes agriculture as an industry ends up being kind of the mule in a hailstorm. They can't quite get out of it. Numbers of legal challenges, for example, that really are, like, even when they don't ultimately succeed, they're still a big deal. You know, some example, like the Des Moines Water Works case out of Iowa just recent years, that was really, you know, a challenge to how agriculture is regulated under the Clean Water Act. If it wasn't successful ultimately, but had it been, that would have been a major event in ag. But you have others like the listing of the monarch butterfly, or the attempt to list the monarch butterfly. That's really an issue about glyphosate. Monarch butterfly is the species that's targeted, but the technology that's really at issue is glyphosate. And so there's a lot of these issues that play out at different speeds. And oftentimes I mentioned, you know, ag as an industry is so diverse and complicated. You know, there'd be issues that are playing out, say, for example, with the beef checkoff in a court system. They may have those issues could have an impact on the other checkoff programs. You know, it's hard for people to see those potential connections, but that's part of it.
Now, you know, when you think about the technology, and you use some of the examples of the adversarial opponents of modern production agriculture, they're well funded. They've gone kind of, you know, they've argued a lot of these different cases. We're seeing the results of a lot of some of their success.
I would say they're creative. I would say that it's a formidable opponent in the ag sector, on the crop protection front, definitely have had some success, but you see the level of creativity and one specific example I mentioned today was chlorpyrifos, one of the common brand name be Lorsban, they're really reaching into that, and I know that don't get too technical for the audience that didn't have the context there, but basically challenging the tolerance level, that residue level that can be. That is a very creative approach, and it was successful.
The most contemporary thing we got going right now is this battle regarding Enlist and Enlist Duo, and it's, you know, that now the EPA is pulling in the Endangered Species Act issue, talking about basically insects, and on a county by county basis saying, you can't use this product.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, in 40 something counties here in Oklahoma, there's 11 or so in Arkansas. But the Endangered Species Act and its role in agriculture is as profound as it already is. That's not going to diminish in the years to come. And relating that back to the National Agricultural Law Center, these are, you know, we're in the final stages of producing a manual for the endangered species, or a, sort of a producer's and landowner's guide to understanding that. So it's written for attorneys and non-attorneys alike that are impacted by these issues, but it's a comprehensive publication.
And you alluded to the fact that the world literally has changed when it comes to ag chemicals, crop protection chemicals, however you want to call it.
It absolutely has changed, and I think that's true across the board. But, you know, look at the seed technology, where you – from Roundup Ready to dicamba resistant, where you have – you know, and those are two different sort of regulatory patterns. You have one, the spray is one, and the seed's another. But that world has just dramatically changed. But that's particularly true there. But throughout the ag industry, it's just dramatic changes have occurred just over the time that I've really been in the ball game, so to speak, the last 20 years.
And you go back further than 20 years, actually, to get to the origins of the Clean Water Act and the continued battle with WOTUS. It's going back to the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. You know, the issue going back to the United States Supreme Court has its core origins in 1972. And there was a lot happening in the country at that time. That was the enactment of the federal pesticide law, amendments to the Clean Water Act. You had other Superfund law and the like, creation of the Environmental Protection Agency during that time. But waters of the United States in particular, you know, that has been an issue that has ping-ponged back and forth within EPA over the years and been landmark Supreme Court decisions, and it looks like we could possibly see another one. Well, we're going to see a decision. We'll see what the nature of it is and whether it's going to be considered landmark or not.
You said, you know, the question is, will they do a real narrow decision, or will they do some more, a more sweeping proclamation?
Yeah, so, you know, that my, it's, you know, you can, it's hard to predict, you know, if you knew what the guys and gals in the black robes were going to do, I'd probably I'd be on a beach somewhere. But it's also, it's not so easy to predict. But my intuition, what I suspect, is that they would not have taken the case up to start with, because most cases don't get taken up by the Supreme Court
right.
When parties ask them to do that. They had a broader reason in mind. That's my feeling. And I just imagine that there has to be an element in here of whatever the ruling is, they would like for this to have enough clarity to provide. Because, you know, we watch it on our television sets, and, you know, as ordinary citizens, we see Supreme Court decisions through our own prism. But, you know, they have a real obligation in administering the court system. You know, that's something that gets lost in our 24/7 news cycle, that, you know, they do have a real function in guiding the lower courts as to what is the law in of the land. And so issues like this, they have to have some sympathy for the lower courts that struggle with this, and parties that are impacted in various ways. So I have a feeling that ultimately they're going to have some swing at some more clarity in this area, particularly just to help with judicial efficiency.
One last thing. You didn't mention this today, but I know a lot of guys are very passionate about it. Right to repair.
Oh, man. Yeah. There was, you know, for a presentation like this, it's what to leave out, you know. But that's a huge one. And that, you know, I would put that kind of at the top of issues in ag, because, you know, you have traditional allies here in ag, you know, in the big, you know, like, for example, John Deere and the producer community. And, you know, this is a tough one for them to resolve. You know, they've worked on it, made a lot of progress. You know, we've seen a new proposal on the right to repair. And we've seen them pop up as proposals anyway a couple of times at the state level. There was one that popped up in Arkansas. And to put that in context, if a state had passed a law like what was proposed in Arkansas, it would effectively become a national standard on that. It would impact everybody. It's a huge area, and you're right. I didn't mention that. It certainly would have fit today, but you know, I think, you know, a lot of, and I should add, we're now seeing a lot of legal challenges there, you know, produce, and there's more than I know about. I know there's two or three that have been filed, and I think there's more than that in different parts of the country. It's producers who are challenging some aspect on the right to repair front, and ultimately what they're wanting to gain is more autonomy over being able to repair their own equipment and not be as dependent as they feel currently in the approach it's taken.
So any feel on how, you know, is that going to be because you've got so many individuals versus a few companies, or is, you know, the populace going to kind of prevail there, or what?
Great question. I really don't know. And, you know, I had when the first case was filed, it was a friend who the farmer sent me the link via text message, and just, you know, it's like, effectively asking who's going to win. You know, I don't know yet. And I told him, I need to get some time, and I'll actually read the complaint. But I said, it's going to be a twist and turns type thing. It won't be fast, but I don't have a feel for this, you know, whether they're successful, how they, you know, is, I just don't have a feel for that yet.
You were asked by the one person in the audience about Prop 12. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's another one of these deals that you've got a state effectively dictating nationally policy. Huh?
Yeah. You know, and there it's in the animal welfare front. And you know, and California was not the first state. They're the biggest. And so when they make a move like that, it makes a big difference. It really can shape part of the industry, a big part of the industry. So, you know, it remains to be seen exactly how that's going to play out. I know that it's been paused. I know there's an effort to get the Supreme Court to take that up. You know, we'll just see. But, you know, yeah, I mentioned that particular issue that I was mentioning animal welfare as an example of consumer influence. And just as you look at trends in the ag industry and where legal challenges, policy challenges will remain or be, that consumer influence as it relates to animal welfare is just one of several examples. And so regardless really of what happens in ultimately in states like California, that base of the pyramid, if you will, that inertia that drove that in the first place, I don't think it evaporates. I think it's there for a long time. You know, we mentioned that Prop 12, but, you know, there's the farm protection laws, you know, that – where people either – some laws are trying to prohibit people from being able to sneak onto farms and take pictures, and others are trying to prohibit it. Sure. And some trying to force it and some trying to prohibit it. But those issues are going to keep coming up. And it's just, you know, reflecting on when I mentioned sort of looking back in 2001, I never would have dreamed, you know, when I was thinking of back then, what is agricultural law? And I never would have thought we'd be talking about people – slipping into somebody's operation, taking pictures, and the First Amendment of the Constitution being a key issue as to whether that's allowed or not. It's, you know, just think, you know, you think about farming and everything that's around it, and you have these major issues like First Amendment of the Constitution. It's a wild, wild thing in and of itself, and there's so many other issues like it. I'm blessed to be able to work in that, and as you could see when I mentioned the staff we've had, you know, it used to be that I mentioned the two senior staff attorneys, Elizabeth Rumley and Rusty Rumley, and myself. We were all generalists. These issues would come up, and we'd say, well, okay, I don't have time to tackle it, so somebody else would tackle it. And then we got to where we had to kind of carve out space, and then one day we looked up and said, we got to figure out how to structure with people who are focused just on environmental law. This thing's eating us alive. We can't get to anything else. Mm-hmm. And then same thing with food safety and food labeling. Same thing with ag finance and credit. You know, some of the issues that, you know, of course, we were kind of scratching the surface here today, but we were talking about carbon. You know, think about crypto assets. You know, think about, you know, how will those be regulated and how will that impact carbon markets? And that have they are tied like a rope around agricultural land. There is a direct line. Mm-hmm. Everybody recognizes that in this carbon space that agriculture and forestry, and I consider forestry part ag, but that nuance kind of helps to point out, they are a necessary component like you can't, you cannot obtain the gains that you want to obtain on carbon emissions or reducing them without working with the ag sector. And you just look at the world population growing, and the already need to become more and more efficient on our farmland to produce more for more people with less resources, to reduce the water that's needed, and to maintain fertility of the soil and productivity. It's an astounding challenge. And you add on top of that this world of solar and wind and carbon, in addition to your traditional production. We're asking a lot from our farmland.
Right.
We're asking a whole lot from our rural parts of the country, especially.
And you said to producers here today, be careful, don't get in a hurry to sign on the dotted line on a carbon deal.
Yeah, and I would say that too about any contract. You know, people, you know, once you sign it, it's a different world, you know, than before you signed it. And definitely on carbon, but you know, I definitely would. You know, you look before you leap, use common sense, and, you know, where you can, you absolutely should visit with an attorney. And I would say the same thing, not just about carbon, but, you know, solar leases and wind leases and the like. You know, those are, they can be pretty technical, and, you know, context defines a lot of things, and it helps to visit with people who have experience both in the law and in that aspect of the industry.
Thanks, Harrison. Harrison Pittman with the National Agricultural Law Center. For your Ag Perspectives podcast, I'm Ron Hayes reporting.